Please join me in prayer. Amen. Well, as I said last week, we're going to be spending a few weeks this month thinking about the Protestant Reformation, the turning point in the Christian history that led to churches like ours today. It was 500 years ago on Halloween, October 31st, 1517, that Martin Luther nailed those 97 theses to the door of the church, at least according to legend. And last week I said that we need to start by appreciating what a challenge to authority that was. Challenge to authority like the authority of Jesus overturning the money changers in the temples. The challenge of saying no to the false authorities and of saying yes to the authority of God's love and saying yes by the power of community. So the Reformation was a challenge to authority, but we still have to think about what it was about. What was the heart of the matter? There's lots of different things we talked about during the Reformation. They talked about the organization of the church. They talked about the nature and the meaning of the sacraments and the ordinances. They talked about the relationship of the church to the state, what I'll be talking about next month. They talked about the priests and their role, the ministers and their role. But there's one main topic that I'm sure many of you remember from catechism class or baptism class when you were young that was at the heart of the Reformation, the topic of salvation by faith. What do you need to do to get saved? Or is there anything you can do to get saved? The Catholic Church had an elaborate system at the time of what they called merits. They knew that God's power to save what was most important. But if you could do, they said, if you could do what was within you to do, if you could do your part by doing things that deserve recognition, that merit recognition by God, then you will have played your part in salvation. Luther called that salvation by works, salvation by the works you do in your life. And for him, the question of salvation by works led straight to the question of the law. Luther said the Bible has two different themes in it, the law and the promise, or the law and grace. And the heart of the law were the Ten Commandments that we heard read this morning. You remember them, right? The first tablet, thou shalt have no other gods. Thou shalt make no idols or graven images. Thou shalt not wrongly use my name or use my name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. The first tablet, four rules about how we're supposed to relate to the divine. And the second tablet, honor your father and your mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal, you shall not lie about people or bear false witness, you shall not covet other people's things. A second tablet talking about the horizontal dimension, our life with each other. One vertical tablet for God, one vertical horizontal tablet for love of neighbor. The tablet, the story, the rules of the works that we are called to do to keep right with God. And for Luther, and the question that comes up then is the question of God's justice. If it's about doing what we can to deserve what we can get from God, then the question of God's justice is the question at the heart of the thing. What do we deserve? Because a just world is a world in which everyone gets what they deserve. That's Luther's assumption. And so the question of God's justice with your life is, what do you deserve? For Luther, the first thing about God was that God was just, and God would do what God's justice required. Now, before I get too deep into this, I want to make a couple of side comments. Martin Luther was notoriously anti-Catholic and was notoriously anti-Semitic. And we must not be either of those things. We can't fall into the trap of 500 years later saying, well, Catholicism, that's all about works righteousness. They understood what Luther was saying, and they had their own Reformation and changed their own tradition. It didn't get frozen in 1518, never to change. And so there's in our Catholic brothers and sisters and siblings an incredibly vital tradition that we can't judge just because Luther had his prejudices. By the same token, Luther was terribly anti-Semitic. And he taught us to think, and too often Christians still think this way, think about the law of judgment as the Jewish part of the Bible, and the words of forgiveness and grace as the Christian part of the Bible. And that's entirely wrong. After all, Jesus was a Jew, and his teachings were Jewish. There's nothing extra that Jesus added. It was all already there. And no religion, neither Judaism nor Christianity nor any other, has avoided the pitfalls of harshness or judgmentalism. And every religion, both Christianity and Judaism and every other, has the capacity to preach the expansive, forgiving grace of a God of love. Synagogues preach God's forgiving love every single week. And so we can't fall into that Reformation trap of replicating Luther's anti-Semitism. So those are my side comments, but it's important for us to remember. Luther could not get past the question of justice. What do you deserve? And Luther didn't feel like he deserved very much. For Martin Luther, the justice of God was not good news. You heard in the story of the Ten Commandments. Here are the Ten Commandments, and then at the end of the story, there's lightning and thunder on the mountaintops, this mountain smoking, and the sound of a trumpet, and the people were afraid and trembled and stood at a distance. For Luther, a just God was the last thing you wanted because of what you would have to expect as what you deserved. Luther was not the happy dispenser of faith that he's painted to be. He had a dark vision and a bit of a dark soul. And he believed that we should be terrified of a just God. He also believed in the devil. And the devil that he believed in is an incredible creature. He looks like a good person. And he convinces you to be a good person. The devil tries to get you to be a good person. Because when the devil tricks you into being a good person, he has tricked you into thinking that you can be good enough, that you're good enough and you're smart enough, like the old Saturday Night Live skit, and gosh darn it, people like you. And then the devil's won. And then too late, you come face to face with an angry God who demands justice, who expects you to get what you deserve. We don't like to think about God this way. We like to focus on the loving God for obvious reasons and for good reasons. We like to skip the middle part here to the happy ending where everyone is forgiven. And you know what? Everyone is forgiven. That is how this story ends. But if you skip to the end, you miss the point. You end up with what they call cheap grace, with sloppy forgiveness, because you've skipped the part where you've had to come to terms with yourself. And you've had to reckon up with yourself in your heart. And that's the heart of what Luther's talking about. That's the question of faith. Do you know who you are? Have you come to terms with who you are? Think about these Ten Commandments from that point of view. Don't worship other gods like money or like power or like sexual conquest. Don't worship that God that tells you if you're big enough and self-sufficient enough, you'll be enough. Don't worship that other God that tells you if only you can get small enough and disappear, then the world won't trouble you too much. Don't worship those other gods. How many of us can say we've avoided that trap? Don't use God's holy name as a cheap tool or an empty, pious platitude, telling people with no sincerity whatsoever, as has been in the news, that your thoughts and prayers are with them. How many of us have avoided that trap? Don't trade restoration and worship for another day of acquisitive striving. Don't dishonor the ones who honor you, or hurt the ones who love you, or deprive the ones who provide for you, or compare your life to others in greedy despair. Don't do those things, it says. Who can fulfill these rules? Who can make it through the week and say, yeah, 100% on the Ten Commandment test? Who is fit to stand before God? That was Luther's basic question. Especially when we remember the teaching of Jesus that says whenever we look at another with objectifying lust, we've already committed adultery in our hearts. Whenever we regard others with hateful resentment, we've already committed murder in our hearts. In our culture of avoidance, when do we ever find an invitation like this to stop and reckon ourselves up? The many ways we did not love God with all our heart and mind and soul and strength, the first tablet. The many ways we did not love our neighbor as ourselves, the second tablet. You can understand Luther's point. If God is just, how will we survive what we deserve? If the question is, what do you deserve, Luther thought, what answer do we have but despair? And that, Martin Luther said, is exactly the point of the law. That is the purpose of the law. That is the purpose of the gift of the law we've been given, to drive us to despair. Not a very nice gift. But the purpose of that is that we can begin to heal. It's still a good point for us today, right? Until your heart is broken open, you can't begin to heal. You all know this. The times in your lives when you've at long last been broken, been disillusioned of those fantasies that you could make it on your own, forced finally to sit like Job, repenting in ashes, in dust. Isn't that when the healing starts? That moment when you're finally broken open? I've been thinking, of course, a lot this week about the shooting in Las Vegas, a crime straight out of Martin Luther's darkest imaginations, a demonic man doing a demonic thing, and I don't know much what to tell you about this man or the thing that he did or the why or what sense it makes. But what we can recognize is that immediately that devil, who looks like a good man, has already been at work starting to help us to avoid confronting, reckoning up who we are as a people in this moment. Immediately, the evasive rationalizations have started. The people who think the solution to a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun have already come to the fore, and they are deluded because they think the world is a place full of good guys and bad guys. And it isn't. Just a place full of broken guys, broken gals, broken people who can't always tell right from wrong, and no simplistic solution will suffice. And the people who think the solution is better gun laws and then we can move on to the next problem, they're also deluded. So, I mean, certainly we need stronger laws about guns. Our system is profane. But simplistic, legalistic liberalism is also so quick to miss that this is a broken world and that we, in our brokenness, are knit right into it. Because the wickedness of the world isn't just the wicked decisions that wicked people make. It's the systems that are set up to trap us all. Gun violence isn't just about the manufacturers and the buyers. It's about this culture of violence we're steeped in, this toxic masculinity, this hubris of ego. The need for investment portfolios to continue to profit off a very profitable gun industry. The movies that show violence without consequence or without meaning. The stories we tell ourselves 1,000 times a week in this culture that people are disposable. Unlike Luther, I don't believe in the devil. But if I did, that would be his crowning achievement. weaving us into a network of complicity from which none of us can escape responsibility. His insight, Luther's, was simply this: we cannot goodwill our way into righteousness, because our goodwill is always knit right into that system. Instead, we have to allow ourselves to be broken open by the confrontation of our own failure to thrive, by the confrontation with our failure to create a world in which God's creatures can thrive. And once broken open, broken upon the law, thou shalt not murder, broken by the question, what do we deserve? Finally, maybe we can begin to receive God's healing love, God's forgiving love, God's reconciling love, because finally there's a crack in our hearts where the love can enter in, because at long last our hard hearts have become accessible. And then broken open and finally able to receive God's love, we can ask, what can we do to help? And perhaps Las Vegas will finally, at long last, be a moment when we as a society are broken open enough to begin to heal some of these things. But this devil is strong. This system is strong. The powers and the principalities of this present age are strong, and they're resilient. And so we have to be vigilant for signs of ongoing hardness and ongoing brokenness in ourselves and in our world. And for signs of hope, because behind that God of the thunderstorm and fire on the mountain, there's the face of a God of love and of reconciliation and of healing. And so we're called to support in our own brokenness every step down the road that anyone takes, ourselves, each other, anyone we work with or find in this world, any step anyone takes down that road to healing, down that road to reckoning up the self, and turning over to God the possibility that things can be better, that we can be healed. Amen.